Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how will President Biden change American immigration policy? And first, how will the second Trump impeachment trial affect the future of impeachment as a constitutional tool? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Former President Donald Trump has made history by becoming the first president ever impeached twice. He also has made history by having his trial take place after he has left office. On today's show, we discuss the constitutionality of the second impeachment trial, the legal arguments advanced by both the House impeachment managers and the former president's legal team, and the future of impeachment as a political tool following this trial. Our guests are Frank Bowman, Floyd R. Gibson, Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law. He is the author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump. He also writes the blog Impeachable Offenses. And Eric M. Friedman, Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Rights at Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. He is the author of Habeas Corpus, Rethinking the Great Writ of Liberty and Making Habeas Work a Legal History. Professor Bowman, the first question I have is, Republicans have advanced an argument that this trial is unconstitutional because it's being held after the president has left office. Now, I know the Senate has voted on this already, you know, making a legal and political statement, but could you evaluate for us the argument? Do the Republicans have a point?
I don't think so. The first thing to do when we talk about impeachment is to recognize one important thing, which is unlike a lot of other areas of constitutional law, there are few, if any, absolute certainties in terms of constitutional law, because unlike most other areas of constitutional law, it's not an area where you can have any definitive adjudication by the courts on any but really the most peripheral kinds of considerations. So when people who study and think about impeachment talk about something as being settled, I mean, we know that we really don't mean that, because no Congress can bind any subsequent Congress on most of these points. And it's really Congress that gets to decide. Now, I suppose the question of post office jurisdiction by the Senate might be adjudicable by the Supreme Court, but I think it's the kind of thing that they'd be deeply unlikely to fiddle with. I think if the Senate says that it has jurisdiction, I think that's pretty much the end of the question for all practical purposes. But assuming that the Senate, like the courts, has the power to make some decisions about what the Constitution means and what they're supposed to do under it, that means we've got to argue this question. And this question about whether or not you can have a trial after somebody's out of office is at least debatable. It's not like the claim that is being made by Mr. Trump's defenders is completely insane. It's unlike, for example, to take a comparison that I like to use, in the first Trump trial, it was repeated by Trump's defenders that, well, in order for there to be a high crime or misdemeanor, the president's behavior must be an indictable crime. Well, nonsense. I mean, at least if we take the overwhelming consensus of people who thought and talked about this for a couple hundred years, no, it doesn't. But on the other hand, the point was raised, notably by Alan Dershowitz, and a number of senators seized on that claim and made it the ostensible basis for their vote to acquit Mr. Trump. So in the impeachment area, almost anything can be argued because there's no real tribunal to say now and forevermore, this is so and that is not. So with that long introduction, let me say that while you can make the argument that the Senate doesn't have jurisdiction now, I think it's a bad argument. It's a bad argument because it rests on a kind of tendentious, I think, kind of textual claim that because the penalties for impeachment are limited to essentially mandatory removal and optional disqualification, that anybody who can't be removed at the time of his conviction therefore can't be tried in the first instance. And I just don't think that's a very convincing argument on its face. And moreover, I think it doesn't really comply with the framers' view about what this whole enterprise was for. That is to say, impeachment. They conceived of it as a means of dealing primarily with dangerous presidents. And one of the kinds of presidents or kinds of people they were most concerned about were people they called demagogues. That is politicians, aspiring politicians who would aspire directly to the passions and prejudices of the people and thereby, you know, bring themselves into power, and once in power, essentially transform themselves into autocrats or dictators. They believe, based on their study of the classical world, earlier republics, that people like this were a special and unique danger to republics. And I think that that's one of the principal reasons why they included the disqualification remedy, because they recognize that people like this, their danger is not eliminated simply by removing them from office, because this power of appealing directly to the passions of the people remains. And I think there are a few occasions when you can sort of look at the modern world and say, dang, the framers anticipated this problem perfectly. And I think we are in one of those moments, in the sense that Donald Trump is the living, breathing embodiment of what they were worried about when they were thinking about impeachment. He's the guy. It took 230 years for him to appear, but he's the guy. And so to say that we can't address the sort of personality and the sort of danger that they were concerned about simply by virtue of the fact that he happens to commit his most egregious offense, his offense of essentially attempting to overturn an election and to install himself as an unelected autocrat at the end of his term before the Senate can complete its trial, I think is not a really plausible interpretation of the Constitution, either from, you know, a textual basis, on a structural basis, certainly not on the basis of original understanding, and certainly not on the basis of any sort of prudential concern about maintaining constitutional order.
Professor Friedman, Professor Bowman is raising an issue as sort of an existential question as to what impeachment means. I'd love to get your response to that. Is it a legal process? Is it a political process? Or what exactly is impeachment supposed to address?
It is, to quote Alexander Hamilton, a process which may with peculiar propriety be called political. But what he means by peculiar propriety is not politics in a day-to-day, you know, jousting sense about, I disagree with him about the Green New Deal or something, right? What he means is someone who is not worthy of the trust of the people because he has broken through the guardrails that the Constitution provides, and therefore, on rare occasions, by a supermajority, we are going to protect the constitutional structure from this out-of-control car that's breaking through all the guardrails. Okay, and in that context, everything that Professor Bowman says about why the claim should be rejected makes total sense. And yes, I, you know, as a career constitutional law professor, don't believe much about constitutional judgments that are reached in the heat of combat on the floor of the Senate, as opposed to a lot of people who have actually spent a lot of time studying this, and in something that's rather rare in constitutional law, all serious scholars who have actually looked into it are of the same view, which is not usually the fact, but that's how it came about that most recently 177 of us signed the same letter taking the position that, yes, an out-of-office president can be impeached, notwithstanding that we disagree about pretty much everything else that may happen in constitutional law. But there's a reason for all that. First of all, there's the practical reason that Professor Bowman ended with, which is what's being popularly called the January exception to impeachment, right? Which is, as long as he misbehaves late enough, then he'll be out of office anyway. But more generally, he can quit just 2 seconds before conviction, you can resign, and then there's nothing you can do. That precise problem, as Professor Bowman alluded to, has been dealt with a couple of times in American history, which is why it comes about that we actually have several precedents for out of office holders being impeached, including quite early in the history of the Republic when they should know what they were talking about. Furthermore, we happen to know that there was at the time a very highly publicized impeachment trial going on in England, which was dominating the press. And we know that the framers were aware of it because they mentioned it, in which an out of office office holder was being impeached and prosecuted criminally at the same time, so that if convicted, they could have confiscated his estate and done all sorts of things to him, which the framers thought was not appropriate for a political process, and therefore wrote, aiming like a laser at that precedent, it shall be limited to removal from office, disqualification of any further office, period, but the party impeached can be proceeded against in separate criminal proceedings subject to all the rules of due process. Okay. So given that language, against the backdrop of the history that we know came to it, and the practicalities and the precedent, you know, as constitutional law questions go, this one has a pretty strong answer, which is why, again, all the academics who wrote about this long before the current events came to the same conclusion, and why I am, you know, not about to take my constitutional law from any transient majority of senators, even if the transient majority of senators this time, you know, happened to come out the way I would. That's because, you know, honestly, because they're Democrats most of them, right? I mean, that's not a basis for long-term enduring decision making any more than I would take as precedent the kind of absurdistan arguments that Professor Bowman referenced from the first Trump impeachment, which were spurious.
And Frank Bowman, you cited one specific argument. This is not really about precedent because each individual Congress can make these decisions for themselves, but the House impeachment managers are making a precedent inspired argument that this is important to be on the record, that this is behavior that will not be tolerated, and there's an expectation of impeachment. Is this trial really about that precedent, or perhaps also is it about specifically the individual of Donald Trump, as you cited, that he's possibly going to run again? And so it's about ensuring that this type of behavior can simply not happen again from Donald Trump if he is disqualified as a candidate in 2024.
The objective here is to do what the Constitution says we can, which is for the House to determine that a certain defined set of conduct amounts to a high crime or misdemeanor, to pass that allegation over to the Senate, to have the Senate adjudge whether that's true, and if they achieve the requisite majority, disqualify the office holder here, Mr. Trump, from ever serving in federal office again. And that's presumably the point. The only reason we're sort of asking these sort of broader existential questions is because we know pragmatically that in our current political environment, almost certainly an insufficient number of Republicans are going to vote to convict him. And therefore, everybody gets to be asking, well, given that we know that as a matter of practical politics, is there any point in the whole exercise? And if so, what is it? A good question. I mean, I think I would begin with the notion that if a president engages in behavior which is as clearly violative of the notion of high crime and misdemeanor as Mr. Trump's has been, then that, I think, confers on the Congress, beginning with the House, an obligation to use its constitutional tools to respond. And for better or for worse, virtually the only constitutional tool that Congress has in such a case is impeachment. So they've started the process that they were given. And I suppose, you know, we shouldn't throw our hands up and say, oh, golly, what's the point? What we should be asking is, why isn't, you know, the Senate collectively prepared to do the job that the Constitution gave it? That's the question. I mean, we know what the answer is, that the Republicans are enthralled to a particular segment of the Republican base, and therefore their timidity is going to cause them probably to not to do what they should. What purpose does this serve, given that hard political reality? I do think to a certain extent it lays down a marker of a kind. Here's another thing, and this is something I've been talking with a number of reporters about today and whatnot, which is some of the effect of this is perhaps being lost in large measure because so many of the Republican senators have decided not to take this seriously. They're behaving as if it's not serious. They're not showing up, some of them. They're sitting in the back, like my former colleague here at the University of Missouri, Josh Hawley, with his feet on the chair in front of him and, pretending like he's, kibitzing in the back of, first-year contracts or something, rather than sitting as, a judge in the most serious sort of decision that any senator can make. And that, I think, is very bad largely because it's a symptom of a general lack of seriousness on the part of many of our institutions, but certainly a lack of seriousness on the part of the institutional Republican Party. But given that we have an institutional Republican Party, segments of which are essentially refusing to take this seriously, should we proceed? I think so. And I think in part because we need there to be a public forum in which they show us who they are. Are they serious people? Are they not serious people? Too many of them are displaying that they're not serious people. And whether in the end we're going to survive as a constitutional polity, if one of the great political parties in a two-party system is no longer composed of serious people, remains to be seen. But I think one function that this serves is demonstrating who is serious about protection of the Constitution and who is not.
Yeah, I would add this. Assuming the Constitution survives another 100 years, another 200 years, it is the fact in all contested constitutional decisions, which happen obviously much more frequently at the Supreme Court level, that at the time the players are alive, everybody understands the politics, everybody knows who Scalia is, everybody knows who Gorsuch is, and in forms of course he would vote that way, and of course he did it for this reason or that reason or whatever. Over time, those people all die, and the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court is still there and is going to have to make it, on its merits, and will be a precedent for better or for worse over time, again, long after the transient political passions and transient political players are dead. And we are still today citing what happened in impeachments long ago, including things like, okay, they dropped an article of impeachment against Richard Nixon because they thought that should be pursued as a regular crime through the criminal courts, which was about tax evasion. Tax evasion is not an abuse of the power of the office of the president. You could do it. I could do it. If he's guilty of that, go prosecute him, right? They dropped one about bombing Cambodia and lying to the American people about it because they thought that's within his outer perimeters of being commander in chief. And okay, well, whatever you may think about why any of those things happened, they are going to be taken seriously at future times, even if some historian says, oh, well, the Republicans did this, the Democrats did that. Doesn't matter. The precedent stands for the future. And therefore, yes, this has meaning, even if at any particular time it's a whirlwind of politics, as all the impeachments have been. The Andrew Johnson presidential impeachment is in clouds of scandal about people being bribed. The Bill Clinton presidential impeachment was one which any number of scholars thought should not have happened. And, you can say Newt Gingrich and the Democrats, because we're all young enough to remember that. 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now, nobody's going to remember Newt Gingrich and the Contract on America. So, yes, those things do have a long-term importance, and it is important to lay down those markers and do the best for history, in the interests of a long-term republic in which, God willing, the future will learn lessons from the past.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump with Frank Bowman of the University of Missouri and Eric Friedman of Hofstra University. Frank Bowman, you have a response to this?
Well, certainly not to disagree. I do think that there is some danger, if we can call it that, of creating some unfortunate negative precedents here. If we have a case, as we do, against Donald Trump concerning his behavior from November 4th to January 6th, which is plainly as grave a dereliction of the president's constitutional duty as has ever happened in the course of our history, and yet somehow or other, we cannot summon 67 senatorial votes to get rid of or to convict him and then to disqualify him. I mean, that does create an unfortunate precedent for the future, because if something analogous happens in the future, people will say, well, there wasn't serious enough. Somehow or other, it wasn't enough of a high crime or misdemeanor to actually to merit conviction. That is troublesome. It is something of a risk in a situation like this. But you can't not do it based on the prediction that will happen, because that simply means that the political allies of the president have a de facto veto on what is or isn't going to be deemed high crime or misdemeanor. And you can't even do it as long as they're willing to, you know, to create this self-fulfilling prophecy that the conviction will not occur. Now, with respect to the particular charges in this case, one concern I do have a little bit is that by choosing to focus very narrowly on the incitement to insurrection in the so-called, what you might call charging paragraph in the Art 1 article, and not focusing, as I think they might have, on the broader question of Trump's long scheme to overturn the results of a lawful election, that not only, of course, gives, you know, Trump's defenders some room to argue in the current case, but also there's an almost a kind of an implication that somehow that stuff is less deserving of our attention than the fact that there was a riot. And my view is that the much more grave constitutional offense was the conduct that happened before the people broke in. And indeed, in my view, there would have been impeachable offenses galore were committed if no one had ever so much as set foot inside the Capitol building, because what Trump did was to try to overturn an election. What he did even on the 6th was to attempt to coerce or induce his vice president to do something that he had no constitutional power to do, which is to refuse to certify an election. Why did he send the people down there? Even if he was just sending them down there not to riot, but to have a protest, well, it was to induce the Congress to do something that it has no constitutional power to do, which is to refuse to certify the election so that in due course, Donald Trump can remain in power. That's in many ways a much more grave constitutional offense than simply inciting violence. And yet the way we've structured this to some extent, and I understand why, it's the emotional core of the claim, but to some extent it diverts attention away from the real essence of what Trump did, and maybe to a certain extent by doing it, kind of, you know, defines deviancy downwards, if somehow or other that wouldn't be enough. Of course it's enough.
Yeah, I agree with that. The focus on incitement, this is why I did not sign the letter of 144 scholars, which got many fewer signatures, that the First Amendment claim was frivolous, right? Because it is perfectly clear that if Al Sharpton had made that same speech at that same place in front of a Black Lives Matter rally and they had gone and trashed the Capitol, not only could you not have convicted Al Sharpton for that, but the whole civil liberties community would have been springing to his defense, and rightly so. So that gets messed up with First Amendment, which has nothing to do with this, because Al Sharpton is not president of the United States. It was an abuse of, a total abuse of the powers of the office, exactly as Professor Bowman said, not to be litigating court cases, obviously, that's fine, but to be bringing extra legal pressures on people not to do their governmental duties. That includes election officials in the states, that includes Vice President Pence, that includes members of Congress. And it is true that the whole frame of the what really is the abuse in just flatly refusing to accept the verdict of the voters, even after it's been upheld by the courts and certified by all the authorities and so on, is really the core of the misconduct in this case. And Professor Bowman's quite right. That would be still the core of the misconduct if the ralliers had gone out and just yelled and shouted outside the Capitol in an attempt to get Vice President Pence to do something which would be a violation of his constitutional duties. So, yes, that's true. This was not as well written, as well thought out as it might be. But again, you can understand why, partly because of the emotional reaction to just being almost killed in your own offices, and partly to the fact that writing up what we have just said, you know, would have taken more time and effort than was available, partly because there would have been an even more messy constitutional situation if they hadn't gotten those articles through while he was still in office, right? In theory, you can bring the entire proceedings against a former official, but, you know, that gives all the more constitutional smokescreens to throw up, and they were eager to do it before Inauguration Day. And so, in classic terms, good enough for government work.
So the last question for both of you, it appears as though the president is likely to be acquitted, you know, as we're recording this. And so therefore, he would have been impeached twice and acquitted twice. So first, is impeachment as a process as outlined by the Constitution broken? The difficulty of getting convictions, certainly in an age of hyperpartisanship, but actually, historically, there's only ever been one member of the other political party to vote for removal, at least at this point, that's Mitt Romney in the last trial. So if it's broken, can it be fixed? If it's not broken, what lessons should we take from this? And then as just as a potential explanation, I know the Senate has the option to acquit, but I believe they have the option to acquit, but then from a majority vote disqualified Trump from running from office. They do not have that option. You're shaking your head. So therefore,
you have to convict by 2/3 before you can disqualify, is what we're both saying.
Okay. So that's not an option. That's not a suggestion. Can this be fixed? Does it need to be fixed? Professor Bowman.
Well, even though it is true, no president has actually been convicted in an impeachment, I would say that up to the Trump occasions, impeachment either worked pretty well or came close enough, to borrow from Professor Friedman, for government work. In Andrew Johnson's case, he escaped conviction by one vote. Lots of complicated reasons why that's so. But in some respects, the impeachment achieved what it was supposed to achieve. That is to say, he was, partly perhaps for that reason, remember, he was just filling out the second of Abraham Lincoln's terms. And although he certainly wanted to, Johnson was unsuccessful even in getting on a ticket to run again in 1868. I mean, so essentially the notion of effectively disqualifying him from American political life was in some measure attained. If you look at Nixon, which is another century before we get a presidential impeachment or anything like it, the Nixon impeachment process worked. We didn't actually impeach him because we didn't have to. And we didn't have to. You just mentioned, and it's often mentioned, that Mitt Romney is the only person in another party, president or senator of another party, who's ever voted to convict. But if you look at the Nixon precedent, Nixon resigned because the members of his own party, House and Senate, marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and said, Mr. President, A, you're going to get impeached in the House. B, it's going to go to the Senate and you're going to lose. And what's more, some of us are going to vote for that. So hit the road, Jack. So in fact, impeachment worked perfectly. It did exactly what it was supposed to do, albeit it was part of a larger investigative process. In the Clinton case, one can argue there shouldn't have been an impeachment at all, but the result, I think, was probably, arguably, the correct one, which is to say he was an immoral weasel. You know, his immorality probably didn't materially affect his ability to be a president, and therefore the Senate basically concluded no high crime and misdemeanor. So I think the first three probably came out either at or very close to where they were supposed to and achieve whatever results they were supposed to. It's only when we come to Mr. Trump's case, there you have, in my view at least, two very clear cases, and certainly the second one is absolutely irrefutable, of impeachable conduct where the job doesn't get done. Now, what do we say about that? I wouldn't say that impeachment is broken so much as I think American politics are broken. And more particularly, the Congress is broken. And the fact that the impeachment isn't serving its assigned function in the Constitution is a symptom of that larger brokenness. So any any effort to fix impeachment requires fixing our political life.
I actually agree with that. John Adams said, the men of Massachusetts could make any constitution work. And the flip side of that is that without virtue, it doesn't matter what the Constitution of Russia says, the Constitution of China says, or anything else. And it's true that the fact that the impeachment mechanism plainly in these both of these last two occasions has not done what it should have done. And I'm probably more skeptical also about the Clinton impeachment than Professor Bowman, but we're obviously in a heavy downward spiral. And that heavy downward spiral is in American politics generally, and leaving aside, you know, moral things about virtue, you have unbelievable gerrymandering, which has increased the political benefits to taking an extreme position of one side or the other in your own party, because otherwise it's going to be a primary, right? Moderate. And this is an artifact of a lot of what's happened in the voting rights area over the years, and partly the obvious voter suppression stuff and the outrageous decision of the Supreme Court invalidating Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which got much less attention than the Obamacare case, but deserved much more. And, you know, we could begin to put it together. But in fairness, has been happening for many years before that due to an unholy alliance between the Republican Party and minority politicians to create majority-minority districts, thereby, again, increasing hyper-partisanship because, okay, we'll give you one absolutely Democratic district for two absolutely Republican districts instead of three moderate, reasonable districts where somebody's going to have to appeal across party lines. And so I would agree with Professor Bowman that when we fix sort of the overlying structure of American politics, then you would expect that, you know, moderate people get elected and will be more conscientious on any particular thing, including impeachment.
We've been discussing Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. Our guests today have been Frank Bowman, Floyd R. Gibson, Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law. He is the author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump, and writes the blog Impeachment Offenses. And Eric M. Friedman, Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Rights at Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. He is the author of Habeas Corpus, Rethinking the Great Writ of Liberty and Making Habeas Work, A Legal History. Thank you all very much.
When we come back, President Biden's immigration and asylum policies, how will they differ from the past? Stay with us.
Welcome back to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. Joe Biden campaigned on promises to reverse many of Donald Trump's immigration policies. The new American president signed three executive orders to alter the previous administration's immigration policies, as well as outline a new approach to amnesty and residency for foreign nationals in the U.S. We discuss the content of these executive orders, what's expected to develop in the upcoming weeks, and the future of American immigration policy on this segment. Our guests are Hiroshi Motomura, who is the Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's authored many books, including Americans in Waiting, The Lost Story of Immigration and Citizenship in the United States and Immigration Outside the Law. And Joanne Lin, who is National Director of Advocacy and Government Affairs at Amnesty International USA. Joanne Lin, we'll start with you first. Can you give us a synopsis of the executive orders, what actually has changed in policy?
Sure, good to be back with you. Amnesty International welcomes President Biden's executive orders announcing steps towards protecting people seeking refuge in the United States. We applaud the president's rescission or cancellation of the Muslim ban and the Africa ban, which had been imposed by the Trump administration. We also welcome President Biden's orders to launch a task force to reunite separated families at the border, to address factors pushing people to flee in search of asylum, to support stronger asylum and refugee protection in other countries, and to build refugee resettlement capacities in Central America. President Biden announced a new executive action that addresses the global refugee crisis by committing to rebuilding the U.S. refugee admissions program. Trump had taken a wrecking ball to the U.S. refugee program, slashing refugee numbers to all-time historic lows. And President Biden has now announced plans to restore and increase refugee admissions to 125,000 per year by September 2022. Amnesty International also applauds the historic step that the president has now taken to address the needs of those forcibly displaced by the climate crisis. Whether it's farmers who have permanently lost their capacity to grow crops or villages that are now literally underwater, people across the world are being displaced by climate change and are on the run in search of safety.
And Hiroshi Motomura, what are some of your impressions of these initial moves that the Biden administration has made in what's been a pretty busy first couple of weeks?
Well, I am not surprised that the Biden administration has moved quickly on these issues. It's not just the executive orders that we're talking about, but also even on day one of the administration to push for legislation or to get the legislative process underway. So that doesn't surprise me. I think that the whole area of immigration, refugees, it became, of course, a big point of emphasis for the Trump administration. And it was very much part of the Trump playbook was to use migration issues to incite and excite his base. And so it doesn't surprise me that the Biden administration is going after that that area quite a bit. It's partly to push legislation that wasn't going anywhere. It's partly to do things to reverse the executive orders that the Trump administration adopted, not just formal executive orders, but all kinds of policies that didn't rise to the level of a formal order, but really mattered. And also, I think, to change the narrative. One of the things the Trump administration did was to remove the idea of or the phrase nation of immigrants from one of the major immigration agencies. And so what we're really talking about is an attempt not just to roll back or to reverse what the Trump administration did legally, but also to shift the entire narrative.
Now, Joanne Lynn, I know that human rights groups had been particularly critical of Trump administration policies. One question that consistently seemed to come up is how different was the Trump administration from previous policies? I know, for instance, the question about so-called kids in cages, one of the defenses the Trump administration laid out was that they weren't the first to start this, that this was a continuation of a policy under Obama. Is it fair to say the Trump administration's policies were really quite distinct and quite different, or was it a continuation of American immigration policies?
The Trump administration adopted wholesale policies that no other president has done in the past, most notoriously family separation along the southern border. And that practice was designed to so-called deter Central American families from coming to the United States, including many in search of humanitarian protection, people on the run for safety and protection. And it was the first time at such a wholesale writ large level that the US government forcibly stripped children from their parents. And even now, several years later, several years after the Trump administration actually sought to end the policy, there are anywhere between 600 and 1,000 children who remain separated from their families. These families' lives are permanently damaged. And the emotional and mental toll on these children is truly indescribable and incalculable, which is why President Biden has made this one of his top priorities coming out of the gates. But importantly, the US practices on immigration and asylum, the dark history doesn't just start with the Trump administration. So certainly the practice of mass family detention which we saw imposed nationally, that started in 2014 under the former Obama-Biden administration, where we saw the overnight construction of mass family detention facilities in Texas run by private prisons, where you have children and their parents, their moms for the most part, locked up together in immigration jails. And I want to be very clear about this. These are people who have come here and voluntarily made their whereabouts and arrival known to immigration authorities so that they can apply for asylum, which is a form of protection here in the United States. It's a legal form of protection, and there is a system of due process that these people are entitled to go through. And so that problem or that situation has certainly predated the Trump administration. I do want to note that while the Biden administration has made several important strides and advances to try to reverse the damages of the Trump administration, it has not done that completely. And so, for instance, if you look at the Remain in Mexico program, a very controversial program, also known as the Migrant Protection Protocols Initiative, this is a Trump initiative that has forced asylum seekers to wait in northern Mexico for months on end at great peril. Human Rights First has documented that over 1,300 asylum seekers forced to wait in Mexico under this program were later kidnapped or attacked while waiting in Mexico. And to be clear, these are people who are entitled and should be admitted to the United States while they're presenting their asylum claims, but the Trump administration had forced them to wait. On day one, Homeland Security, this is on January 20th, 2021, Homeland Security announced that they were going to suspend future processing of under Remain in Mexico. However, thousands of asylum seekers remain stranded in Mexico. People who've been waiting in recent years and months remain there where they face great danger. And Amnesty International is calling on the Biden administration to immediately bring these people to safety in the United States so that they can present their asylum claims.
And Professor Motomura, one of the things that strikes me about this is how much of the policy has been generally set by executive orders. You had indicated in your initial remarks about the need for legislation. What ultimately should be legislated and what can comfortably be changed via executive order? Because I think one of the real concerns here is kind of a whiplash in immigration policy, where this policy changes so dramatically as a result of who the president is.
Yeah, well, certainly we've seen that with Trump being as active and aggressive as he was for 4 years, that this lot can be done by executive order or other types of presidential decree without legislation. So a lot of the issues that we have in migration policy in this country are susceptible ultimately only to solutions that would change actual laws in terms of statutes, in other words, legislation. And so, for example, one of the things that Biden administration has started to push is a bill that would provide legal status to most all people in the country without legal status, legalization program. It would consist of different phases. So in other words, people who are recipients of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, you know, they would be on a faster track to getting green cards, in other words, lawful permanent residence and then citizenship. And so at that level of actually granting permission to stay in the country legally, indefinitely, and then being on a path to citizenship, that's going to require legislation. Another thing that I just want to point out is this is goes dovetails in a different way to what Joanne was saying, is that the Biden administration is trying, I think, at least modestly or maybe in small terms, to try to resurrect attention to the reasons why people leave, feel forced to leave and make perilous journeys to the United States due to conditions in their home countries. And so the idea of international economic development in Central America is something that's going to require a different kind of legislative action, which is appropriations. So that's important. But it's always been true that a lot of immigration law on the ground, I mean, what really happens is a matter of discretion, a matter of enforcement, a matter of priorities. And so I think it's important that there be legislative change, but no matter what, it's going to matter who makes these choices about, for example, if you look at migration protocols, migration protection protocols in Remain in Mexico, a lot of this really has to do with taking a system, which as Joanne suggests, is really established in law, international law and US law, and really make it work, right? So some of this is going to require making sure that people get hearings in a timely way. I think it's important also that they have the assistance of lawyers to help navigate the process. And so there's got to be both legislative change, but it also is always going to matter who's in the White House, because so much of what really happens is bureaucratically and detailed on the ground. For example, a lot of attention has been paid, and rightly so, to the infamous Muslim ban, African ban, at sort of the broad level. But we shouldn't also forget that processing, that so-called invisible wall, making people wait forever, requiring interviews that had never been required before. These are small things, but they're at presidential discretion and agency head discretion. But that's a point of attention that the new Department of Homeland Security Secretary is going to have to pay a lot of attention to in the coming years, and hopefully sooner than that.
It may jump in for a moment. You're absolutely right that, you know, the immigration law and system has been like on a pendulum for years, if not decades. And the people who pay the greatest price are immigrant families and communities. As Hiroshi mentioned, for instance, while President Biden has rescinded the discriminatory, xenophobic Muslim and Africa bans, there's nothing that prevents a future president from coming in and reimposing them or imposing new additional bans. So Amnesty International is calling on Congress to pass what is called the No Ban Act, which would permanently check any president's ability to impose bans that discriminate based on religion. So it's critical, like we're urging Congress to do that, that it's not sufficient for Biden just to erase what Trump has done, because we have seen how easy and how devastating those bans can be. On the legislative front, yes, you know, the president has announced that he has sent a bill to Congress. There has been no legislative text yet seen or introduced. The Democrats have a very narrow majority in Congress. It's razor thin in the Senate. You know, it's basically 50-50 with a tie settled by the vice president. And then the Democrats in the House have a weakened majority since they lost seats in the 2020 November election. But I think it's absolutely essential that this Congress take up immigration, at least in some form, to try to fix these longstanding problems that Hiroshi mentioned have to be addressed by the legislature.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Biden administration's new immigration policies with Joanne Lin of Amnesty International and Hiroshi Motomura of UCLA. So Hiroshi Motomura, the Trump administration altered several of the conditions that had been previously issues raised for asylum, including gender-based violence, potentially asylum from climate change or from family conditions. Are these expected to be changed under the Biden administration?
Well, I think that if you take a step back and just think about this, not so much even the 50,000 foot level, but maybe the 15,000 foot level, the Trump administration was really on a mission in some sense to try to gut the system of asylum and refugee protection in the United States. I mean, it did a lot of things that the courts blocked and a lot of things that the courts didn't block, but the Trump administration's basic attitude, I think, was that it was going to make it as difficult as possible to apply for asylum. And so it did a number of things. But one of the things it did that you just alluded to is it adopted some rules by attorney general decision, actually, that make it harder to win asylum cases based on gender-related violence would be one, based on membership in a family that's being persecuted would be another. And so, you know, that's one area where those decisions can be reversed. Another one is simply doing away with the Remain in Mexico program. Another one is to allocate more resources to actually hearing people's cases. Another one is to treat people humanely while their cases are pending. Another is to not try to shunt asylum applicants to other countries where they actually don't have an opportunity to secure protection that they would have in this country. This is something that took place on many different fronts. I think the Trump administration worked in many different angles on this. It's something that requires, I think, both immediate attention, and yet at the same time, it's going to take time to undo the various pieces. Some of it is going to require legislation to really protect. Some of it is going to require appropriations, but some can be done by reallocation of resources. I also, you know, I'm concerned that a lot of the rank and file here in these agencies are going to resist or at least drag their feet on some of these changes. I think one of the things the Obama administration confronted was the fact that he was trying to rationalize the system of enforcement in ways that I think drew a lot of valid criticism. But I also think that the good things that Obama was trying to do were resisted in many respects by the rank and file. And so I think Biden will have that same problem.
No doubt that President Biden is going to have an implementation challenge in Homeland Security for the reasons that Hiroshi mentioned. And in particular that, you know, I'm not speaking about everyone in Homeland Security rank and file, but the most, I would say, anti-immigrant ranks inside that agency have really had their moment under the prior administration and are going to be fighting tooth and nail to defend and keep in place the initiatives. And there were many that the Trump DHS was able to put in place.
So Professor Motomura, one issue that certainly arises frequently when discussing immigration questions is the future of DACA. What's expected as the future of DACA? Will it continue to be an executive order? Can it be passed as legislation? Or is it likely to face quite a bit of opposition?
Well, one of the things that Biden has really pushed or said that he would push, and I mean push in the sense of advocate for, is that is to include the DACA recipients in legislation. But what they would get from legislation is something that DACA itself as a executive action couldn't give them, and that is that this legislation would provide lawful permanent residence, a durable immigration status, in other words, lawful status for DACA recipients, and then put them on a path to citizenship. And so that is one piece of legislation. I think what we're going to see in legislation is that it's going to be a long negotiation. It's going to be a difficult negotiation. It may well be that the DACA recipients are the part, the group of people that benefit from this legislation that probably has the highest chance of making it through the process with green cards and a path to citizenship. I think it'll be easier politically to give green cards to DACA recipients than to a much larger group of people who are undocumented. This is just as a political matter, but it's going to require legislation. Now, the other question that's maybe part of your question is, what happens in the interim? Or what happens if legislation doesn't pass? In other words, what happens to DACA as DACA? DACA, you have to remember, is not a permanent status. It's kind of a quasi, it protects people from deportation. It comes with work permit eligibility, but it's subject to, you know, 2-year renewals. And it's not, and there are some discretionary denials of DACA. And so I think the Biden administration is committed to keeping DACA and to actually, to broadening it. I mean, he uses the word to fortify DACA. The one problem with that I should mention is that the DACA is subject, is the object or the target of a legal challenge that's now pending in the state of Texas in federal district court. And so we'll have to see what happens in that case, because the argument being made by the state of Texas and a few other states is that DACA is illegal, as beyond the power of President Obama to adopt it in the first place. I mean, I think that's entirely wrong, that argument, that I think there's all kinds of legal reasons why DACA is quite legal. But we may see a situation where the judge issues a decision that requires some modification of DACA. And of course, that will go through an appeal process. So that's a complication. But I think the Biden administration is committed to keeping DACA as DACA and trying to get a more permanent legislative solution.
So our final question, Joanne Lynn, what ultimately do you recommend the Biden administration prioritize in these changes in immigration policy?
So there are 4 things that the Biden administration can and must do immediately. The Biden administration needs to swiftly end the Remain in Mexico program, also known as migrant protection protocols. They just need to dismantle it altogether and bring in all the people who are waiting on the Mexican side of the U.S.-Mexico border to ensure that they have access to a safe and humanitarian process for their asylum case. Secondly, the Biden administration must stop misusing the public health authority that was invoked by the Trump administration to block and turn away asylum seekers and migrants This is public health authority that has been invoked during the time of COVID. And the Biden administration has said from every platform possible that they are going to listen to the science, follow the evidence, and there is no medical basis or public health basis to justify the blocking and expulsion of asylum seekers and migrants based on public health and COVID. Third, the Biden administration must end mass family detention. This is a carryover and legacy of the Obama administration. It is an anathema and an affront to human rights and to our country's values. The last time we had children locked up with their parents in incarcerated settings was during World War II, when Japanese American families were rounded up and held in detention camps. Biden has to end this scourge. Fourth, Biden needs to release people in immigration detention. Again, these include children, families, asylum seekers who are being locked up in punitive jail situations. There is a COVID risk for these people who are by definition in settings that are imprisoned, where they cannot socially distance and cannot implement the public health measures necessary. And this is also, again, contrary to our values and not necessary for public safety. So those are the four measures that the Biden administration can and must immediately take. And Amnesty International is going to hold the administration's feet to the fire.
We've been discussing immigration policies, specifically the new executive orders issued by President Biden and proposed changes to U.S. immigration policy with Joanne Lynn of Amnesty International. She's the National Director of Advocacy and Government at Amnesty International USA. And Hiroshi Motomura, Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of many books, including Americans in Waiting, The Lost Story of Immigration. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.